Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. In this series, we're exploring the role that love plays in inspiring us to face significant challenges, such as living with cancer and mental health struggles. Throughout this series, created in partnership with Ralph Lauren's Pink Pony and Champion Better Lives initiatives, we'll hear from inspirational speakers from across the globe as they share stories of love in all its guises, from personal relationships to community activism. My guest today is Deborah James, author, podcaster, and campaigner. Deborah was a deputy head teacher leading national research teams into growth mindsets in schools. Then, in 2016, at the age of 35, she was diagnosed with bowel cancer, and her life with her young children and husband was thrown upside down. Rather than disappear into a cancer cave, she started a social platform, Bowel Babe, to debunk the myth that young women don't get bowel cancer. She uses her platform to support major UK cancer charities, including the Royal Marsden Cancer Charity, and writes and presents the award-winning podcast, You, Me, and the Big C, for BBC's Radio 5 Live, which has over 1 million downloads. Her book, If You Cancer, How to Face the Big C, Live Your Life, and Still Be Yourself, was published in 2018. Deborah also writes a column for The Sun Online, Things Cancer Made Me Say, which is read weekly by thousands of people. Those of you will remember that Deborah was a guest on the Ralph Lauren Pink Pony podcast series back in October 2019, and I'm delighted to have her join us again today. Welcome, Deborah.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here almost a year later chatting, albeit in a very different climate, Paul.
I completely agree. It's so nice to hear your voice. So you have 113,000 followers on Instagram, over 22,000 followers on Twitter, and you've used your profile not only to spread awareness, but also to build up a loving, supportive community. Was that your original intention when you started to share your story publicly? And how has your online community supported you during these really difficult moments?
So never my intention. I think nobody ever sets up anything to say, oh, I want to have lots of followers, albeit a small drop in a very large ocean. I think you set things up because you want to, or at least I do, you want to share your story, help others. And I think I got a lot more back than what I gave, to be honest with you. I think it's always the way, isn't it? And I know that we've talked many a times around this idea that actually the fruits of what you give out will come back in abundance quite often. And for me, that came back in an abundance of love, simply from sharing my story. I got people sharing theirs back with me. And on my small little kind of community platforms, very much people want to kind of engage in a very deep level and a level of kind of heartbreak, actually, and celebration about cancer, about some of the tough things that they're going through. I have to be honest with you, emotionally, I'm very honoured that people want to share their stories with me. It's quite a lot to emotionally take on, and I'm learning to look after myself emotionally first before trying to help others. But I think I'm blown away by the community of love. And actually, sometimes when you're going through the toughest times, I get the biggest amount of strength from that small little drop in the online ocean. And I think it's amazing.
So what was the one thing that your online community of love and support and solidarity taught you that you didn't expect?
I think it teaches you you're not alone. I think when you're going through a pretty tough time, you obviously want to pull on your friends and family, and they don't actually know what you're going through. They can try to pretend to understand, but really you actually need somebody who's almost experiencing exactly what you're experiencing. And you realize when you kind of like put it out there, you throw the net out and you realize there's other people in exactly the same position as you and they're experiencing it. So when I say I am really scared, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm about to get my scan results. somebody else knows exactly how I feel. I mean, I can say it to my mum, I can say it to my husband, but they're not really going to get what it's actually like to possibly have the floor whipped from beneath your feet, to live between scans, to wonder what is around the next corner, to wonder whether you'd be alive in 2 weeks' time, 6 months' time, a year's time. And other people who are going through it do. And I think that is what surprised me in terms of actually other people felt the need to also share. It wasn't just a kind of, it wasn't a one-way stream of me saying like, this is what it's like to live with cancer. It's the amazing strength that people draw from it. And also it then transfers into real life. So I think there's this crossover between what people imagine the online world to be like and what real life is like. And the reality is that people say, well, how do you get followers? And I'm like, well, this is pre-lockdown, obviously. The reality is that you act in exactly the same way as what you would do in real life. You make friends and you make connections and you reach out to people. And that's what you would do in the real world. And I think from that, I've made real life friends who are really good supports for me. In fact, one of them, we just ran the marathon at the weekend together and we met online. And so it's amazing how it can transfer and that strength of community can really see you through the tough times.
I want to pause on this for a moment because what you're saying somehow defies conventional wisdom. Online communities, people you meet through Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, the conventional wisdom is those relationships are more distant. They're less authentic. They're less tangible. And the really important relationships are your friends and your family, the people who are more proximate to you. And what you've said and what I've heard, which I find so fascinating, is that through your own online community, you found people, particularly people who are survivors of cancer, who know exactly how you feel. And that has been, in some ways, more powerful, more authentic in some ways, than the closer relationships, because they can be in your shoes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think your family and your friends are the most important relationships. But the reality is that you also don't want to pile the pressure onto those relationships. You just want to be a friend, as I always have been, to my university friends, to my husband, to whatever it is. I want to be a daughter. I don't want to be the patient or the person who is really scared, or I just want to be Deborah. Whereas when in the online community, you meet people who get you as a cancer patient, not as a victim, but as somebody who's living with cancer. And I think in that way, you can connect very deeply with people in real life as well. And I think it is incredibly important, actually. And I think it is quite amazing how the positives can come from kind of finding people online. And I know that, you know, the online world comes up with a lot of criticism. And I would say I've been pretty clear on my communities in terms of expectations. And that is really, this is a positive place. This is a place for sharing the highs and the lows, but it's not a place for negativity. It's not a place to start trolling or saying anything negative. And I'm really strict about that. And I think I'm pretty clear in terms of, if this isn't for you, please don't come here. And as a result, I would say everybody is incredibly positive and are there for a reason as well. They want to feed and nurture that positivity.
So you are a great advocate for the power of honesty, and you share all aspects of your life with your followers. And how do you find the courage to be so open and so honest and so transparent in moments which I should imagine are extraordinarily vulnerable?
Yeah, I think I've learned that I do sometimes take a little bit of time for myself to process things, just because I've learned now that the reaction to it, I need to almost learn how to handle that positively or negatively. But I've kind of learned, I suppose, that actually it's better just to be really honest. I think people like to create a curated feed that is the life that they think they should be presenting. And the reality is that actually, everybody can see behind it. Everybody knows if you're having a rubbish day. There's no point in it. Actually, I'm not sure the benefits of it. I think I'm not saying that I would necessarily go around spreading the kind of woe very much the opposite. But I also think it has to be raw and real, because otherwise nobody's going to engage in it ever.
So in your first book, you have a chapter inspired by your children. And I would like to know how your relationship with your family has strengthened or changed during your engagement with cancer. And what's your advice for communicating, particularly with kids and your kids, about cancer?
My kids have grown up knowing that I've got cancer. It's really interesting. I was speaking to my daughter. My daughter doesn't really know what life without cancer's like, in terms of mummy always has cancer, it's part of her life. I think as a result, they just have learned to ride with the ups and downs. And the thing that I quite like is actually they're both quite self-absorbed, really. They just want to get on with their own stuff. And I think that's quite positive, actually. It shouldn't really be about me, and it should be about them and growing up and their future. My biggest advice to anybody is to be really, really honest with your children. It depends on the age, but I think my kids are now, I can't believe I can say this, I've now got a teenage son who's 13 and a nearly 11-year-old girl. And I mean, my daughter was 7 when I was diagnosed. It's incredibly different. But now there's no point in me hiding things. And there's also no point in me scaring them. I think be really transparent. Obviously, if you have a 3-year-old child, they don't need to know the nuances of the situation. But I think the worst thing you can do is to hide things from them, because they're going to make up the bits in between. And it's always going to be worse. It's never going to be the truth. And they're probably going to be a lot more scared, actually, about what's going on than if you're just really honest about it. If you're just really, really honest. I think my kids, we have quite a dark sense of humour in my house, like really, really dark, to the point that Eloise is, my daughter is kind of like, well, if you were to die, can I have your shoes? And I think that's just the way it is. And I mean, we don't always talk in that way exactly, but they do have quite a wicked sense of humour as a result. And I think that certainly raises a few eyebrows in their own friendship circle.
I think there's no greater testament to the fact that you've built trust and you process things together that they're able to be vulnerable but be witty at the same time. So you co-hosted the podcast, You, Me, and the Big C on Radio 5 with your friends, Rachel Bland and Lauren Mahon. And Rachel originally came up with the idea for the show, and then she very sadly passed away from cancer in 2018. How did you manage to cope with the loss of a friend while at the same time continuing to build on her legacy? And what lessons did she teach you along the way?
Sadly, Rachel was one of the first friends that I had to say goodbye to. And since Rachel, there's unfortunately been a lot of friends, very close friends, that I have had to say goodbye to. I think it's the nature of the beast in terms of the world that I live in. And sometimes it's quite a dark world. But I think as a result, it genuinely shows me the value of every single day. And that's incredibly cheesy to say that. But the reality is that even recently during lockdown, I was recording for Panorama here in the UK. And I was doing an investigative piece of journalism on the impact of cancer from COVID. And unfortunately, during the making of that film, I filmed saying goodbye to another very good friend of mine who was diagnosed at the same age as me, a girl called Kelly. And what I have learned from both Rachel and Kelly is life has to go on with or without us. And good can come from really hideous situations, whether that is awareness, whether that is campaigning for something. Off the back of Kelly's death, there was a meeting with Matt Hancock. We talked about basically having to get cancer services back here in the country back up and running. And unfortunately, sometimes it takes those case studies, those really kind of heart-wrenching situations to make people say, oh, hang on a moment, this is actually what's happening. And then someone like me, if I have the privilege, and it is a privilege to have another day living, then it's the ability to kind of say, okay, what can I do with this? And knowing what I know from Rachel, knowing what I know from Kelly, they were very much like, actually use my situation as an example for something to come of it. And I would feel exactly the same. you know, the fact that I'm sitting here speaking to you another year later makes me campaign very hard for access to particular drugs. I'm currently sitting on the board to try to get my current regime approved here in the UK. I was granted it through compassionate use. And I think actually, yeah, it teaches you to kind of say, okay, well, I'm very blessed and very lucky to have this and I've got to do something good with it. I also know that, you know, somebody said to me, why do you run? And I do lots of, like I said earlier, I just ran the marathon and I do it because I can. And I think if you have the opportunity to feel okay, to be living, you've been given a platform or earned a platform or whatever it is, and you know how awful something like cancer is, then the least you can do is do something positive with it so somebody else doesn't have to go through it. I think that's almost the easiest part of it, actually. I think it's the least thing that you could do, actually, in those people's names, because actually they would do anything to have another day here.
So you alluded to it earlier, but you have been a passionate spokesperson for your community and you've been vocal about not allowing cancer patients to be forgotten during the coronavirus pandemic. So tell us what you are advocating for in relation to cancer patients and what is it that you're hoping to achieve through this advocacy?
Yeah, I think the biggest shock was obviously we're in a global pandemic and things are pushed aside. But through my investigations, I think it's very clear and very evident here in the UK that the collateral of, well, everything from every walk of life, but especially in cancer, could end up being just as large as COVID. And I think the thing that is heartbreaking is this idea that we have a healthcare system that's having to choose between who it treats. And unfortunately, in the UK, when our services are compromised, cancer patients were graded. And actually, we started putting a value on a life in terms of whether we could treat that or not, not from a monetary perspective, but purely from a resource perspective. And that's absolutely heartbreaking because that's how some of my friends died, because they were denied treatment that could have saved their life. Not necessarily forever, but the reality is when you're 35 and you could be given a little bit of treatment to allow you a couple more months of life, it is a couple more months of life if you've got a five-year-old son. And the idea that actually everything has been pushed aside. We now know that we have a backlog, a massive backlog here in the UK in the system. We have thousands of people who are sitting undiagnosed with cancers because people were too scared to come forward. So not only were we now having to play catch up, we will then possibly go into a second wave. We've already been told recently in the last 24 hours that if we can't get COVID under control, cancer services will yet again be compromised. And I think it's not acceptable. I totally appreciate we're in a pandemic and hard decisions have to be made, but this is life and death and COVID isn't our only health issue here in the UK. And we can't become a COVID service. We have to continue as a health service. And I know that we do have capacity when we utilise the private sector, when we ring fence cancer care, which is what we should be doing. It can work. We just need the forward thinking to do it. And people are trying to make it work. I know that there are passionate people in the system, then we need to allow them to do their job. But unfortunately, as we know, there's massive restrictions. Safety has to come first. I'm not for a second saying that COVID isn't scary. I don't think I've met a clinician up and down the country who doesn't say it's not a threat and isn't a big risk. The challenge that we've got is, say, somebody like myself, I have a 92% chance of dying from my cancer. And the likelihood is that I would survive, touch wood, COVID, should I happen to get it. Now, it is about the wider society and we have to protect everybody in society. But it's the balance of understanding that there are some people who only have today. And I might be one of those. And me aside, not being selfish, I have an entire community of people that I care very passionate about who only have today. And I think a lot of the policies that have been put into place assume that we all have tomorrow. They assume that, oh, it's okay. Don't worry about not celebrating your birthday this year because you've got next year's birthday. But the reality is that some of us don't. So it's about finding the balance to allow people to have a good quality of life today, to access healthcare today that will enable them to have tomorrow. And I think people need to be reminded of that.
So part of this conversation and what brought us together is Ralph Lauren's philanthropic efforts to provide as much cancer treatment as possible. And I know they recently contributed to the purchase of a COVID-19 testing machine for the Royal Marsden, where you're a patient. Could you tell us why this COVID testing for cancer patients is so vital?
So I've actually been lucky to benefit from that exact machine. I'm married to a French man, so we went to see our family in France, and quarantine happened, obviously. Now, despite the fact that I'm on critical treatment that I must have in order to keep me alive, I had to go into quarantine. Now, the only way that I could have treatment, and my treatment is incredibly timely, I must have it every 2 weeks, is to prove that I'm COVID-free. Now, I therefore went into the hospital. I was isolated. I had that test. The test results came back within a couple of hours, and I was then allowed to have treatment and then go back and quarantine. I think it is paramount that patients are kept as safe as possible because we know that comorbidities is a massive risk factor. But the reality is that 4 months ago, when I had suspected COVID, I didn't have it. But we unfortunately had to wait 10 days for my test to come back. This was right down kind of at the beginning of April when we were just working out what the testing protocols were. And unfortunately, as a result, I was not allowed to have treatment. Not because the Royal Marsden was saying so, because the wider rules were saying absolutely no way until I had a negative test. And it did come back negative. But as a result, my cancer treatment was delayed. It just so happened, not necessarily directly because of that, but because of a couple of things. Actually, during lockdown, my cancer that was asleep actually grew and became active. And I ended up having to have radiotherapy during lockdown. I'm now back in a much better place, and hopefully my cancer is still asleep. But it's just, we don't want to have a situation where patients cannot access treatment because they're not clear from COVID. And actually, when we have the technology to ensure that patients are safe, it's just brilliant to be having access to it when I know that actually that's not happening across the country. So to have the support of Ralph Lauren to do that is great. I can see it will actually save lives.
So you are about to publish your new book, and its title is How to Be Alive When You Could Be Dead, and it will be released in early 2021. I love that title. And it's all about the power of positivity, about cultivating a growth mindset. So I want to know what inspired you to write it.
So when I was in education, I was a deputy head. I actually undertook a massive national research project into growth mindset and the use of growth mindset in schools. So essentially the idea that we have fixed or growth mindsets, so obviously based on Carol Dweck's work. And whilst it's been disputed over the years in terms of how we can use it, the thing that we realised is, yes, it needs to be taught in schools. And as a result, now across the country, because of that research project, actually, the idea of resilience and growth mindset is now taught in primary schools. But the key thing that we realised as teachers is actually you can train people in growth mindset and you can teach them what a growth mindset is. But unless they have the skill set to apply it, it's totally pointless. It actually has no impact whatsoever. And I've realised that really, in terms of everything that I've been through, mindset is key. It's probably the only thing that we have the power over. And it's all good and well knowing that we have the power in our mind, but unless we know what to do with it, it's incredibly hard. So the book is essentially about how we can apply it to everyday situations. How can we get out of a hole? How can we learn to take one day at a time? How can we basically flip negativity into positivity? And what are the baby steps that we have to take? Now, nobody's perfect. I can't do it all the time. I know the theory. But I think it's understanding that actually the power is essentially in our minds. And I think that growth mindset is incredibly important. But I also think that actually it has to be a conscious thing. It has to be something like exercise. So when we build exercise into our daily regime, build healthy eating into our daily regime, but do we work on our mind? Hopefully we do, but probably not as much as we need to. Sometimes I think we're all guilty of saying, right, okay, I'm in a bad place. I'm going to go and see a counsellor for or a therapist for the next 2 months. And then we do it and then we think that it's done. And then we kind of go, okay, right, I've done. And no wonder our concerns crop up again 6 months later. And just like exercise, it's never going to be a finished product. We're never going to be a fully working growth mindset human being. But I think we can continue to always, always, always work on those skills and relearn and relearn and relearn and relearn that resilience as well. And it's all about feedback. It's all about saying, okay, hang on a moment. That didn't go very well. What am I going to do to improve? And essentially, that's all we did in the classroom. So it's essentially taking a lot of my teacher hat into real life.
So you strike me, every time I've met you and encountered you, you kind of bubble over with positivity and enthusiasm, which I suspect is one of your superpowers. So tell me, what are the things that you credit with keeping you so positive?
I credit a bank of support around me. The online support is absolutely one of those avenues. Obviously, my friends and family. I think also it's genuinely realizing, like I said earlier, the difference between living and dying. And I feel so lucky to be living right now because I know how easily that can change in a second. And then it's from a really practical perspective. It's things like exercise, actually. Exercise is a huge part of my life. And obviously I can say all the things like my kids and everything that keeps me ticking. But I think balancing the mental challenge of living with cancer is incredibly challenging. And there are some really, really rough days. So it's finding your toolbox. And my toolbox includes running. It includes, well, it's really challenging because I was going to say one of the hardest things is actually in lockdown, having a lot of your tools being taken away from you when they're external tools. And for me, socializing is a massive external tool. You know, going to kind of talks, going to events, going to the cinema, going to the theatre, immersing myself in culture, actually, that is a tool. It's an escapism for me. And I have to say, in lockdown, actually removing that has been a massive issue for me. So I've taken up cooking, which is a bit of a miracle because I was a rubbish cook before. So actually, I'm really enjoying it. I've found that that's almost like a new wind down for me. I kind of like make my own little recipes. I'm doing all those recipe boxes at the moment, you know, where you kind of like mix and match. We all have to start somewhere. So I've been quite enjoying that. And I think, yeah, it's finding those tools that you know work for you. Otherwise, sometimes it's quite easy, and I'm guilty of this, to pick up on quite a lot of the negative tools. So I could quite easily be guilty of drinking too much wine or spending too much money. So you go down a kind of habitual route that can be quite negative sometimes. So I think it's trying to replace those and just being conscious of it. Nobody's perfect. I do drink too much wine and I do too much online shopping. But I think it's like, at least I'm recognizing that and then kind of trying to replace them with other things.
So I'd like you to give a message to, if you could convey one thing to people who are living with cancer, and then something to say to the loved ones of people living with cancer, what messages would you convey to them based on your own personal experience?
So to those living with cancer, I would say that none of us actually know what's around the corner. I think it's holding on to hope, holding on to research, holding on to the idea that there might be tomorrow, and if we're blessed enough to have tomorrow, anything can happen. If I'd believed every statistic in the book, I wouldn't be speaking to you now. I'm living when I should be dead, and I know that, and I'm kept alive by some drugs that didn't exist when I was first diagnosed. I appreciate this doesn't happen across the board. I am petrified about what might happen in the future, but I suppose I have to be incredibly grateful for the fact that I have now. So if you're living with cancer, I think it's surrounding yourself by stories of hope because they do exist and they are out there. And actually, for me, those people give me hope, and I hope that I give others hope. So if you're newly diagnosed, I have a lot of people that will come to me and say, okay, I can see you running a marathon. I can see you doing this. Okay, that gives me hope. For those of family and friends, I think it's kind of almost realizing that actually it's okay not to totally understand what that person's going through. And it's also okay if that person doesn't want to engage with you about everything to do with their cancer. I think it's almost unhealthy, actually. I think it's almost, remember who they were before cancer. They're still the same person. They're not a victim. They're not a loser. They're not a kind of winner. There's no losers or winners. They're not a kind of weak person. They're essentially just somebody who is trying to live their best life with a challenge. And we don't have the same kind of like, oh, look at them, they have cancer, when it comes to things like heart disease or diabetes or whatever it is. And it's destigmatizing it. I suppose it's kind of, unfortunately, one in two of us will get it here in the UK. And I think, you know, it is part of our life, and actually we have to learn to live with it. And research gives us hope that we can learn to live with it. So it's understanding that actually more people will live with cancer than will die from it. And if we can put into place some roadmaps for ensuring kind of early diagnosis from day one, nobody in the world should ever have advanced cancers. And I had a really interesting conversation with a guy called David Crosby, who's just written a piece bringing together 100 researchers looking at a roadmap in terms of what should cancer look like in the future, and essentially imagine a world without cancer. And I had a really interesting conversation with him over the idea that actually right now, still around the world, we firefight, and we firefight at the end of when cancer is too advanced. And the only way that we can reverse this for future generations is to stop. It's to pull every single resource that we have, from scientists to genomicists to the governments to pharmaceuticals, together and to say, okay, we have the technology, we have the skills to actually prevent cancer before it even happens, whether that is through tracking, through wearables, through identifying who's at risk, through changing habits, through education. But we almost need to not draw a line and forget about everybody that has cancer, but we have to start turning the tide now. And we can have a really good roadmap in terms of preventing cancer, and we can be in a world where cancer isn't a problem. And I think to friends and family, I think it's recognizing that people are talking about this. They're talking about the fact that, you know, our children, our children's children should be growing up in a world where cancer isn't an issue. But I think it's having that hope and that belief that things will happen when we talk about it and when we support the right causes.
You've spoken a lot about pausing and taking the time to care for yourself. And we're part of the series is to talk about love of others, love given to you, but also self-love, caring for yourself. So what's one thing that you prioritize as an act of self-love?
It is exercise, which is also an act of self-pain sometimes, I have to be honest. But it's, for me, it's whatever it looks like, it's taking half an hour of my day to do something active for myself, because that makes me mentally feel better and physically feel better. And that for me is an act of self-love. And then occasionally eating nice food. I love food, actually. I have to be really honest with you. I love really good food. And actually today, before we chatted, I just cooked like a really big breakfast. You know, when you have like a bit of everything, and actually taking the time to eat nice food and putting the love into the food that you eat rather than just like grabbing on the go. I would say actually lockdown has reinvigorated my kind of slow down mentality when it comes to kind of enjoying the food and the wine and the kind of everything that comes with that. I think is an act of self-love, actually. I think it is a brilliant ritual to have in your day rather than just eating because you're hungry and you have to.
So Deborah, what's a final message of love that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would say actually giving love out can sometimes seem really hard to do, actually, especially if you're knackered, you don't understand the situations that you're in, you're scared. But if you're just open and honest and kind of just be yourself and share kind of your vulnerabilities, I suppose, which in a way is sharing your love into the world, you'll be surprised at what you get back. And I think what you will get back will carry you through the rough times. You'll find yourself in a massive community of love that will carry you in the darkness.
Deborah, every time we speak, I come away more energized and more optimistic. And your positivity and your love is infectious. So thank you for everything. And it's so lovely to see you a year later again.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Paul.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations, created in partnership with Ralph Lauren. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about the Pink Pony campaign, Ralph Lauren's global initiative in the fight against cancer, as well as their Champion Better Lives initiative, please check out the Ralph Lauren website. And for more information on the Conduits and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.